Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 26, 2014, during live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleforum conference call on property rights in the Supreme Court, Limelight, and Nautilus. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome two experts, Mr. Aaron Panner, who is a partner at Kellogg, Huber, Hansen, Todd, Evans, and Feigl, and Mr. Thomas Saunders, who is a partner at WilmerHale. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. And I think we're going to get started today with opening remarks from Aaron Panner. So, Mr. Panner, the floor is yours.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Limelight decision, which came out at the beginning of June. And just to give a little bit of background, I'll give a little bit of background about the case. And it's a little bit convoluted, so that's going to take a couple of minutes, and then talk a little bit about some of the lessons, I think, that practitioners or court watchers and those interested in the Federal Circuit and in property rights can take out of the case. This case involved a patent infringement suit by Akamai Technologies, which is the largest provider of a service called Content Delivery Network Services. And the way a content delivery network works is essentially if you have a website, your CNN, you don't want to have to deliver all your content yourself. You want to be able to rely on a service provider to deliver your content. Akamai is the largest provider of those services, and they sued Limelight, which is a competitor, for infringement of a patent. And the patent involves a technique for delivery of what are called embedded objects. Embedded objects are essentially content that is within a website, and the claims of the specification of the patent and the claims basically talk about gaining an advantage by being able to deliver the base web page from the service provider domain. So in other words, the content provider's domain. So CNN could deliver its base web page, and then the somewhat larger files that are embedded within the page could be delivered by the content delivery network. That's technical background. But at issue, one of the main issues at trial was whether under the language of the claims that Akamai had in its patent, whether Limelight carried out all of those steps. And one of the issues was that Limelight said we don't do this. We really do our service quite differently. But the issue that ended up getting attention from the Federal Circuit and eventually the Supreme Court of the United States was one of the issues was that the way that the claims were written, they required carrying out four or five different steps. One of the steps was to modify the URL, the internet address, not the numerical address, but the letter address that identifies the place on the internet where the content is available. That has to be modified so that the requests go to the content delivery network. In the way that Limelight service is set up, Limelight doesn't do that. The modification of the URL is done by the customer, by Limelight's client. And so Limelight said, you can't hold us liable because we don't do all the steps, even if, assuming for the sake of argument, that the steps that are done are the steps that are described in the patent, some are done by us, some are done by clients, and therefore nobody is directly infringing the patent. And skipping some of the procedural back and forth, eventually the district court decided that under existing Federal Circuit law that was correct, that Limelight couldn't be held liable because it didn't carry out all the steps. Akamai appealed that judgment to the Federal Circuit. and initially the Federal Circuit affirmed, and then the Federal Circuit granted review en banc. And I don't suppose there are many non-lawyers on the call, but that meant that the entire panel of 10 judges at the time, 10, would hear the case. And or maybe it was 11. But in any event, the en banc court did something kind of unexpected. They had granted review in another case, a separate case, that presented a somewhat related issue involving, instead of direct infringement, indirect infringement. So you can be liable if you perform all the steps of a patent, or if you practice the invention in another way, you make a patented article, for example. You can also be liable indirectly if you either contribute to infringement, which is to, for example, you provide a non-staple article of commerce, you provide some device that's only useful in infringing a patent, that could be considered infringement, indirect infringement, even though the one who uses that device, not you, is infringing. Or you could induce infringement, which is you encourage someone else to, you actively encourage somebody else to carry out a practice an invention. You'd be inducing infringement. And so the related case really involved that question of induced infringement. The Akamai case, as it was then called, as it came up to the Federal Circuit, involved direct infringement. But the Federal Circuit did something kind of unexpected. It was not unexpected that it would decide the two cases together, but what it ended up doing was saying that it wasn't going to revisit the standard for direct infringement that the district court had applied. And instead, what it would do is look at whether there could be indirect infringement in a circumstance where no single party or no party is directly infringing the patent, or no party is liable for direct infringement of the patent. And the court kind of, I guess, I would say, twisted things around a bit and managed to say, well, there could be direct infringement even though nobody is directly infringing. And if all of the steps are carried out, even if nobody individually carries out all the steps, either directly or vicariously, you could still have all the steps carried out. And in that circumstance, you could have someone be liable for inducing infringement if they carried out some of the steps and induced their, induced another person to carry out the remaining steps. And that was the holding of the en banc Federal Circuit. It splintered, as it sometimes does in these cases. I think there were 6 judges who joined that opinion. There were 4 who dissented and said, and essentially would have stuck with the panel's approach, and one judge, Judge Newman, who would have expanded the scope of liability under the direct infringement provision of the statute. And the Supreme Court, after some time, granted review of that decision, and they reversed. And what they said was, to be liable for inducement to infringe, you have to have someone who is liable for directly infringing the patent. And that was based on the language of the statute and precedent of the court that, while not squarely resolving the question, had certainly pointed in that direction. And the court said, we're not going to kind of delve into the policy issues here. There may be a question. There was an issue that Akamai was trying to raise about the Federal Circuit's interpretation of the direct infringement provision. We're not resolving that. But what we're saying is, on the assumption that that's right, that the direct infringement standard that the Federal Circuit applied is correct, which is the assumption on which we granted review here, it cannot be the case that you could have induced infringement when no one is liable for direct infringement. One of the things that I think is, and so that's just a description of the holding of the case, which I hope was more or less more or less objective. I should say that I represented Limelight in the Supreme Court. So it is, I can't help but see the case from their perspective, but I hope I've been more or less down the line in terms of describing what happened. One of the things, without getting into a lot about the specific case, I think one of the things that's very interesting about this opinion, frankly, is how plain-spoken the Supreme Court was in reversing the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit, as I'm sure that everyone on the call knows, is a specialized court, and it's set up to address issues of patent infringement. Among other issues, but they're a specialized court that deals with patent law matters. And there's a line in the opinion of the court, which is only about 10 pages long, 11 pages long, but there's a line in the opinion where it says, the Federal Circuit's analysis fundamentally misunderstands what it means to infringe a method patent. That's pretty strong language. When you think about the fact that the Federal Circuit, again, is a court that's there to bring uniformity and expertise to issues of patent law. And at the time that they've since had a somewhat redeeming decision in CLS Bank, but at the time that Limelight was decided, it turned out that there had been five decisions from the Federal Circuit that had been reviewed by the Supreme Court to that point. There were six total, all of them involving some aspect of patent law. And the Federal Circuit had been reversed by the Supreme Court unanimously in each case. And I think that reflects a level of both attention to matters of patent law by the Supreme Court and a concern about the Federal Circuit's adherence to the Supreme Court's precedent and to the statutory language that is probably intended to send a message to the court with regard to future cases. I probably used more than my time here, but I do think that it'll be interesting to see the extent to which the Federal Circuit sees Limelight and some of the other decisions this term as sort of clipping their wings with regard to trying to come up with innovative, almost legislative solutions to problems that they perceive in the application of the patent law. So, Tom, do you want to take it from there?
Sure. Thanks, Aaron. And just for purposes of disclosure, we represented Akamai in the proceedings. Just sort of one point of clarification to start out with is that this issue that arises in this case of divided infringement is really something that is unique to method claims. If you have a claim on a product, the issue doesn't arise because the person who puts in that last component is deemed under longstanding law to be the person who made the final patented product. So there's always going to be a direct infringer. It's only in these circumstances where you have these multi-step methods where you can end up with arguments as to, well, what happens if other multiple people are performing those steps. I will say that sort of where we are now and looking forward is the Supreme Court's decision has essentially acted as a giant reset button that's put the case back a number of years and back onto some of the direct infringement questions on which it started. It was an unusual posture because in the district court, Akamai had said, we're only pursuing a direct infringement theory. We're not pursuing an inducement theory. As Aaron mentioned, it was the Federal Circuit sitting as a full court that on its own initiative said, we're not going to decide that direct infringement question. We're going to an inducement theory, even though it was something Akamai hadn't argued. And so the Supreme Court has now said, well, that inducement theory doesn't work, but we're not deciding here anything about the underlying direct infringement theory. And so the Supreme Court judgment, which should issue in a few weeks, will then return the case to the Federal Circuit. And at that point, the Federal Circuit will have to make a decision about whether it wants to go back and revisit its circuit precedent on the direct infringement question. And if it does, then we could essentially be back to where we were a few years ago. You know, turning for a minute to the Nautilus case, which also in disclosures I worked on an amicus brief that was in support of the petitioners in that case. The issue in Nautilus is the indefiniteness requirement, which is in Section 112 of the Patent Act. You know, the background to this is that the Federal Circuit in 2001 had used some language that appeared to say that there is a very high standard for proving that patent claims are indefinite. And what the Federal Circuit had said is that only if a claim is insolubly ambiguous or not amenable to construction will we say this claim is too uncertain and therefore invalid under the statute. This sort of created a lot of confusion and disagreements about sort of what the standard was and how it was being applied. You know, read literally, some of the language the Federal Circuit was using seemed to say that you would go through all of the ordinary acts of claim construction, and only if at the end of that a court just simply could not come up with any meaning to a claim term would you then say, no, this term is indefinite. You know, other panels I think were pushing back on that notion and saying, no, it's not quite that strict. There had been a number of cert petitions on this question, and after denying them for a few years, the Supreme Court had granted in the last possible spot for the case to be heard this term and said, we are finally going to take this up. You know, I think there was a fight in terms, not much of a fight in terms of the language being used. You know, the extreme reading or the broadest reading of insolubly ambiguous and not amenable construction wasn't really being defended. On the other hand, you had some pushback. Nautilus as the petitioner and the one challenging patent validity was really pushing on the point of having clarity in patent claims. And you had the respondent pushing back and saying, you know, there are limitations on language here and the amount of clarity that you're demanding is too much. In the end, the Supreme Court came out with an opinion written by Justice Ginsburg that tries to take it down the middle. And, you know, if there's sort of one word to describe the opinion, it's balance, or that's what it's searching for. Now, as a result of that, it has a bit of an on the one hand, on the other hand quality. The court comes in and it says that there are a few points, really there are more procedural points that we can all agree on in terms of the claims of a patent. First, the relevant perspective here is that of a person of ordinary skill in the art. So we're not talking about claims that are clear to a judge, claims that are clear to a layman. It's claims that's clear to the relevant scientific audience, someone of ordinary skill there. They also say, of course, the claims themselves have to be read in light of the patent specification and the prosecution history to help shed light on their meaning where appropriate. And then also the indefiniteness is measured at the time the patent was filed. Now, beyond sort of those concrete procedural points, the opinion then ends up sort of articulating both sides of the argument. On the one hand, it says we can't demand that claims be too precise just because there are inherent limitations of language here. And I think some of this reflects the fact that the court as an institution hears a lot of constitutional cases. It hears cases that involve ambiguous statutes. So I think it just has a keen sense that there's always going to be some ambiguity out there. We don't want to be knocking down patent claims left and right because we're trying to hold them to some impossible standard. On the other hand, the court said, but there's also very important interest here in clear notice. If you have patent claims that are ambiguous, you end up essentially expanding your patent rights de facto because you have a zone of uncertainty and people are scared to get too close to the edges of your claims. Also, the patent drafter is the person who is in the best position here to avoid the ambiguity up front by being more careful there. And so having sort of articulated the interests on both sides, the court ends up coming out and saying, well, the test here is that the claims must, quote, inform those skilled in the art about the scope of the invention with reasonable certainty, close quote. And so the court says, you know, it's not clear to us that what the Federal Circuit has been doing in practice is that far off from here. We're not going to micromanage the practice here, but the Federal Circuit's sort of word choice and the thrust of insolubly ambiguous, that's not the test. We're switching it over to a reasonable certainty test, and then we are going to send the case back down to the Federal Circuit and have it apply that test to the facts of this case in the first instance. To me, in contrast to sort of Aaron's comments at the end, although the Nautilus case was one of many reversals this term, it was interesting that the tone of the case was a lot less biting than the Limelight opinion, and also the net result there was the court not coming to any clear rule or directive, but rather sort of tweaking at the margin the standard that's being used, and then leaving a lot of power in the Federal Circuit's hands to interpret that going forward. And I think that the result of this is you're going to have a period of uncertainty here, because you can just picture these cases being briefed, and there's something in the Nautilus decision for both sides to cite in terms of the articulation of these competing principles. And it's really going to come down to the Federal Circuit applying this on a case-by-case basis before we can tell what this is going to mean in practice. It could end up being incredibly significant, just because if you think of the various fronts on which someone is fighting in patent litigation, be it on infringement, be it on certain invalidity doctrines, indefiniteness had become so difficult that I think people were deterred from bringing the claims, or they were brought and were quickly disposed of. And to the extent there's more teeth in the doctrine, I think that you could see indefiniteness arguments being something that's made routinely in cases. Almost by definition, for any patent, the person who's challenging the patent, I feel like you can see almost every case having an obviousness argument and an indefiniteness argument. And depending on sort of what happens in those first few Federal Circuit cases back on remand, they may set the tone for then what the lower courts are doing and whether this becomes sort of a very robust area in which patents are actually being invalidated, or whether it falls back into the old pattern of being a very difficult argument to make out.
Well, I'll jump in next. This is Aaron Panner. I think Tom's description is excellent. We also filed a brief on behalf of Friends of the Court in support of petitioner in that case. And I think that one of the critical points that Tom mentioned but's worth emphasizing is that the court did not apply the standard that it adopted to the case before it. And I was reminded of a case that I was involved with a few years ago called Twombly. And for those of you who are lawyers, the case ended up not attracting a lot of attention, but it is now one of the most cited cases that the Supreme Court has decided in the last decade because it reset the standard for what was adequate pleading on for a motion to dismiss. What sort of a pleading could survive a motion to dismiss? And there had been there had been an articulation of a standard that, like the amenable to construction or insolubly ambiguous standards that the Federal Circuit had articulated seemed extreme. And the Supreme Court it was the Supreme Court's own standard, but the Supreme Court granted the case and said that it was going to change the standard somewhat. But what was critical in that case, I think, was that the Supreme Court actually applied the standard and held that the complaint that was at issue was inadequate. And without wasting a lot of time talking about Twombly, in what seemed important to the lawyers involved in that case was we thought it was very important that the Supreme Court apply the standard, that simply articulating a standard and saying, well, now Second Circuit, go and apply it, would not have brought the same kind of clarity or relief to the area of law, precisely because it is it's sort of a common law problem, and these linguistic formulas that can be that sound sort of reassuring and sensible, trying to apply them in particular cases is hard, and so illustrating the application in particular cases is extremely important. And the fact that the Supreme Court didn't do that really is why I think it is fair for people to wonder exactly what the impact of the case is going to be. And it is a signal that I think that their concern about the Federal Circuit's application of the standard was not as marked as their concern about some of the other decisions that they reviewed over the course of the term. Because if they really thought that this was, sort of off the reservation, they would have had to be able to apply it. And the fact that they didn't, I think, indicates that even under the correct standard, this case, which this case is sufficiently hard that they couldn't decide it. The other thing I think that's interesting about Nautilus is that it does illustrate the extent to which there remain problems under the current statute that are areas for reform. Obviously, people have been talking a lot about legislative reform of the patent laws. This is actually a point to which I'm somewhat indebted to my partner, John Thorne, to give credit where it's due. That people talk a lot about legislative reform of the patent laws, but there's actually a great deal of room under the patent laws for judicial reform and court-led reform that will have to come either from the a federal circuit that is willing to rethink some of its approaches to problems, or from the Supreme Court, or for some combination of the two. And I think that at a minimum, Nautilus sends a message that the court has sufficient concern about the problem of vague patents in this case, that it wants to see the needle moved somewhat more towards a more demanding standard. How that will play out, as Tom, I think, quite rightly says, is hard to predict. But I think that the fact that the Supreme Court took this on and has taken on a number of these cases that are designed to tighten up a little bit, I think, the standards for establishing infringement and for sort of collecting as a patent plaintiff, I think is a reflection of concerns over where patent law is and has been over the last few years. And it's a reminder to me, one of my specialties is antitrust law. And antitrust law is really a common law area where the whole project of antitrust law reform was a purely judicial project, and it was one that was extremely successful. It took a couple of decades, but the change in the way that antitrust law, it began with academic work, and then it translated into the courts, and antitrust law has really been completely changed in a direction that at least I think defense minds, the antitrust lawyers would say, better reflects sound economic thinking and appropriate concern for the welfare of consumers as opposed to competitors. And I think that there's something like that project going on with patent law right now, and so it's going to continue, I think, to be very interesting to watch because there's a lot of issues that remain I think, ripe for further efforts in the courts. And with that, I think, I don't know, Tom, if you have anything you wanted to add.
I think it'd be great to move on to questions.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corrigan, and we'll now open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. And again, that's star and then the pound key. Two quick things. The first is I know some of you joined us late because our reminder email was due to technical difficulties went out about a half hour late. So for those of you who joined the call late, I remind you that you can find this entire telephone call posted as a podcast on our website at fedsoc.org within the next 24 to 48 hours. So if you missed the beginning of the call, feel free to check out the podcast on our website to hear what you may have missed at the beginning. And we do apologize for those technical difficulties. The second thing is a quick programming note. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern, we will be doing another installment of our Courthouse Steps Teleform series. Tomorrow's Teleform call will be on the Noel Canning decision that was handed down this morning. So again, that's tomorrow, June 27th at 2 p.m. Eastern. On Monday, at a time still to be determined, we will be doing one on Hobby Lobby. And then on Tuesday, we'll be doing one on the Supreme Court's decision in Harris v. Quinn. So with that, we do have one question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So we'll go to our first caller now. Again, if you have a question to ask, it's star and then the pound key. Caller,
okay.
You're on with the Federal Society's Teleform.
Hi, this is John Rowland, Constitution.org. What is the impact of this likely to be on practices in the industry? Because we now have carved out a way in which a strategy, perhaps, by which there can be swarm infringements, where no one is directly and particularly responsible, but which everybody gets a piece of the action. And it seems that this would largely dispel the ability to patent entire categories of inventions.
Well, this is Aaron. I suspect Tom and I have different views on this, but let me take a first crack, because this is obviously the kind of question that the courts are concerned about. And I think there's sort of two answers to it. First of all, in a circumstance where people sort of enter into some kind of a contractual arrangement or a joint arrangement to perform the steps of a patent, that's a circumstance where, under ordinary principles of vicarious liability, there might well be liability for that. So this was actually a question that came up at argument in the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor sort of suggested that in a circumstance where people are entering into a cooperative arrangement, they might have a joint venture, and there might be vicarious liability. Whether it would be so straightforward, as you say, to have that sort of a situation. That's not the situation in this case. But the other point I think to make is that most method claims are drafted from the point of view of a single alleged infringer. And there is no, you know, this is this case has obviously been litigated for a long time. No one, there may be a different perspective on the call, but my own, I think we were able to say that no one had really come up with an example of a claim that cannot be drafted from the point of view of a single potential infringer. You know, that certainly was true of the claims that were at issue in this case. And so, and I, you know, from having worked on other cases involving method claims, I think that practitioner, you know, patent prosecutors and do and have for many years tried to claim inventions from the point of view of a single alleged infringer. So, you know, the idea that this would create some sort of big loophole, I think, is not, you know, is not not warranted.
Yeah, and as you may expect, I disagree and think that is a serious concern. But it is a concern that can be addressed by the Federal Circuit, depending on what it does with direct infringement. But I think that if you end up in a situation where, because of the Supreme Court's ruling and then whatever happens going forward, that the performance of the claimed steps by multiple people does not give rise to any sort of liability other than in sort of certain narrow circumstances, like where one is the agent of the other in the technical sense, that you could see a lot of opportunity for abuse. You know, one of the examples that we talked about in the Supreme Court was, imagine you have a patented method on treating a disease by co-administering two drugs. Can you have a situation where two people get together and, you know, try to, you know, make sure they use all the right language to say, we're not each other's agents, we're not forming a joint venture here, but hey, you know, you administer drug A, I'll administer drug B, and we've gotten around the patent. And so I do think that particularly, as you saw from some of the amicus briefs in the Supreme Court, the biotech industry is very worried because they have a lot of different types of patents that are method patents that have multiple steps in the claims, where you could see someone saying that whether or not this is drafted to be directed to a single actor, there's still an opportunity being created here for people to split up the steps. You know, one example I'll give out there, the Biotechnology Industry Organization walked the Supreme Court through the steps of the Boyer and Cohen patent, which is really the fundamental patent on cleaving DNA from one organism and inserting it to another. It was the basis of their Nobel Prize, and said, hey, look at these steps here. You know, it would be pretty easy for two people to structure a quote-unquote arm's-length relationship to divide up these steps. And so, you know, it can't be the case that such a fundamental discovery here is one that can't get patent protection.
Any other thoughts? Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. And I know we had a couple extra people join. Just a reminder that if you missed the beginning of the call due to our technical difficulties with the reminder email going out, that this entire podcast will be posted on our website within the next 24 to 48 hours, so you can always go back and catch what you missed, and we do apologize for those technical difficulties. So we'll do... We've got enough time for a few more questions, so if anyone would like to ask a question, we'll do a last call here. Press star and then the pound key if you'd like to ask another question. All right, looks like we do have another question.
Hi, this is James Lawrence with Coates and Bennett in Cary, North Carolina. Could you guys speculate on the timing around when we might get resolution, a final resolution on the 271A direct infringement issue from the Federal Circuit? I know the parties have asked the court to review the 271A issue en banc. When could we potentially see an answer from the Federal Circuit, and then when might this go back up to the Supreme Court and finally provide some clarity?
Yeah, it's Tom Saunders here. So technically the Federal Circuit can't do anything quite yet, because the earliest that the judgment from the Supreme Court could issue is actually tomorrow. But so I expect sort of sometime in the next week or so you could see a judgment from the Supreme Court. It's not clear. The biggest uncertainty here is sort of how long it's going to take the Federal Circuit to decide what it wants to do next and in what form it wants to hear from the parties. Akamai filed something, it filed a statement in the Federal Circuit 2 weeks ago proposing a full briefing schedule, saying that sort of both parties have cited new authority in the Supreme Court, they've refined their positions, you have new data points here, opportunity for amici to come in, let's rebrief this case. If the Federal Circuit were to do that, then I think you would see briefing extending into the fall, an en banc Federal Circuit argument either squeezed in at the end of this year or in the first quarter of next year. And then, you know, given that they're familiar with this issue, I'm not sure it would take as long as normal to get out an en banc opinion, but you could easily see it being sort of next May or June before the en banc court, with dissents there, presumably, would have an opportunity to rule, which would then tee it up for a cert petition for the court to be heard in a petition coming up in 2015 for argument either at the end of that year or in 2016.
Let me just add that I'll certainly be interested to watch as well.
All right. Well, I know we had a couple people join. Are there any final questions? Again, to ask a question of either of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Star and then the pound key. And for those of you who did join us late as well, another programming note, our next scheduled telephone conference call will be tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern in a special Courthouse Steps edition on this morning's Supreme Court decision in Noel Canning. And then we'll also be having teleforums on both Monday and Tuesday covering Hobby Lobby and Harris v. Quinn. So stay tuned to your email and our website for updates on that.
And I actually have a question I would jump in and ask Aaron, because I'd be interested to hear his thoughts. And lots of people have been asking me this question, which is just the pace. Obviously, this was an extraordinarily busy term for patent cases. And lots of people debating, you know, is this the new normal? Is there patent fatigue on the part of the court? I'd be interested to hear what you think.
Well, I'm not the world's most perceptive court watcher. I guess they've already granted, what, one or two from the Federal Circuit for next term. I think my own perception, it's obviously going to go up and down a little bit, but for people who aren't aware of this, the Federal Circuit was created in 1982. And between 1982 and 1995 or so, the Supreme Court paid almost no attention to patent law, and the Federal Circuit was really on its own. Between 1995 and 2000, you know, the early 2000s, there was a little bit more interest. There was Markman was decided, which is a case about claim construction, and Warner-Jenkinson was decided, which was a case about the doctrine of equivalence. But there wasn't, you know, Markman affirmed, and Warner-Jenkinson was a little bit of a, you know, mishmash. in terms of what ended up coming out of that, and then Festo was also about doctrine of equivalence. But I think starting with I guess KSR and eBay, you know, Merck Exchange cases, the Supreme Court's level of interest has increased, and that has corresponded to the Solicitor General increasingly encouraging the court to take patent cases. And I guess my own perception is that for as long as it remains the perception, which I think it certainly is now, that patent law is not functioning very well, and that the patent system is potentially not simply encouraging innovation, but is also impeding innovation by putting a tax on investment and you know, productive activity through excessive litigation. I think as long as that perception remains, that the court is likely to take seriously petitions for cert involving important patent law issues, and will continue to ask the Solicitor General for its views about the cert worthiness of cases. And as long as the Solicitor General, you know, as long as this administration or the next administration continue to have concerns about patent law, which this administration has made very clear that it does, that I think the pace of it may not be like this term where there were actually six cases, some of them very small, but nevertheless, I think that it's likely that, you know, you're going to continue to see a relatively higher level of activity. Tom, I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you'll serve a few cases a term may be the new normal, especially given how important these issues are to our economy and, you know, just the view that the Supreme Court has that maybe it did ignore patent law for all these years, but it's just too important to leave solely to the Federal Circuit. The one that I'm interested in seeing is obviously you have a lot of change that's going on at once. It's the old curse of, you know, may you live in interesting times, and in an area that's all about balance and getting the incentives right to encourage investment without, as Aaron says, going too far and ending up with too many patents or bad patents that gum up the economy. It's one of these things where when you've changed five doctrines all at once, you almost wish there could be some cooling off period just to see how this plays out in practice. I suspect that we're not going to have that respite, and the court will continue to be involved and continue to be tinkering with these doctrines for the foreseeable future.
Well, any final thoughts?
Thanks for asking me to do this.
Absolutely.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both of our experts today. Thank you to our audience. We apologize again for the technical difficulties in delaying the alert email. But again, you can always download or listen or stream this podcast at our website. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Don't forget to join us tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern for our Courthouse Steps Teleforum on Noel Canning, and stay tuned for the times for our teleforums on Monday and Tuesday on Hobby Lobby and Harris v. Quinn. So until that, next time, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.